This is program C-1076. I welcome you to another week of our verse-by-verse journey through all of God's holy word. Today we are going to begin our study of the book of Hebrews. Now there are a lot of people who believe that Hebrews should be counted among Paul's letters. I do not happen to fall into that particular camp. I believe that this is an anonymous letter. There is no claim by Paul anywhere in it. It does have many characteristics of Paul's writings, but that could be just as easily explained as it being from one of his close associates, even one of his students. In fact, chapter number 2, which I'll go into in detail once we get there, indicates that the author of this letter received his information about the gospel from the apostles, from those who personally witnessed the events of the atonement. Whereas we know from the book of Galatians, Paul makes a big deal out of the fact that he did not get his information about Jesus from the apostles. He got it straight from Jesus himself. And so I doubt that he would have written the words that we will see at the very beginning of chapter 2. So I think that we can narrow it down to one of Paul's close associates writing this, but not Timothy, because Timothy is actually mentioned in the end of the letter as being recently released from custody. So my suspicion is that Timothy made his trip to Rome, as Paul had requested him to do in his second letter to Timothy, and that Paul was executed, that Timothy was probably detained briefly because of his association with Paul, but because Timothy was a younger man, not high up in the church like Peter had been and Paul had been, because they had just both been recently executed by Rome, they released him, and so he would have returned back to Ephesus, and I think that that might also help us understand that the book is connected to that general area of the world, that is Asia Province or Asia Minor, what we call Western Turkey today. I also happen to be of the opinion that there's an extremely narrow time window in which this letter would have been written. And it's related to two huge events in first century church history. The first one we've been talking about a lot lately, and that was the burning of Rome in the summer of 64, from which the Neronian persecutions of the church began. Those persecutions, which ended the lives of many Christians, including the two apostles we talked about, Peter and Paul, were pretty much limited to the area around Rome there on the Italian peninsula. Elsewhere, people were not being caught up into it, unless, of course, like Paul, you were a ringleader of this cult, as he was thought to be, and you're grabbed in Asia and sent off to Rome. So we have the persecutions going on, which made, I think, at least some Jewish persons who believed in Jesus think about going back into the safety and security of their Judaism. Because at that time, Judaism was a very well-protected faith. Josephus goes through a lot of evidence that Jewish people had Roman protections for all sorts of things related to their faith. And so just because the Christians were being persecuted, that didn't mean that if you were Jewish, you couldn't retreat back into your Judaism and be safe legally. Now that's going to change, though, in the spring and summer of 66. Because that's when the Jewish rebellion against Roman occupation in the Holy Land began. And so that's my window that I think we can narrow for the writing of this letter. Between the persecutions beginning in Rome in late 64, maybe early 65, and the major deterioration of Jewish-Roman relationships at the beginning of 66, because it wouldn't do them any good to retreat back into a faith that was having less and less favor within the Roman Empire. And so let's just imagine that the book of Hebrews is probably written right around the winter of 65 going into 66. With all that in mind, let's go ahead and read. Hebrews 1, 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers in the prophets in many portions and in many ways. Now, the English is actually kind of backwards to the way that the Greek reads, because the author begins with the idea of many portions and many ways, many different ways, many parts, different areas that God in ancient times was working through his prophets. So the picture is like the book of Genesis and the books of Moses that follow Genesis, and then the stories of the kings and the chronicles and all of the things that have all of the stories of the prophets throughout all of the Holy Land and even a little bit beyond, where God was trying to deal with his people. That's how this person starts, because he's Jewish and he's speaking to a Jewish audience. So he says, we know that that was happening. And then verse 2, in these last days, so in the here and now, because remember, the last days is actually a time period that stretches from Jesus' first coming all the way to his second coming. But this author is particularly focused at the exact moment where he's writing. In these last days, he has spoken to us in his Son, that is Jesus that we're talking about here, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. So the author says, God talked in a lot of different ways, a lot of different areas, through his prophets in the past. But now he has spoken to us through his Son, through Jesus Christ, who is the heir of everything and who was actually there at the very beginning when all things were made. I suspect that the Gospel of John has easily been written and disseminated by this time, and that the author is familiar with that famous prologue to the gospel. Now, in fact, I suspect that the Gospel of John was written a few years before this, in the mid-60s. And you remember how it says that in the beginning was the Word, and that's clearly about Jesus, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. And that's going to be very important in the book of Hebrews as well. And all things were made by him and through him and for him. Paul actually talks about that in a couple of his letters. So this emphasis is on the fact that Jesus is God incarnate. He existed in the very beginning itself. He was the Creator. But he is now, because of what he did on the cross, because of his salvific efforts, because of his atonement of mankind through his death and resurrection, he is now the heir of everything. You remember in the resurrection, Jesus said, all authority has been given to me on heaven and in earth. So he gets everything. He's at the top of all because of what he did. So a little bit more about Jesus, verse 3, he is the radiance of his glory. So he's the shining forth of God's glory. And that also kind of echoes the beginning of John, that no one's ever seen God, but the only begotten God who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him to us. He has been the glory that shines forth as the light of this world. And he is the exact representation of his nature. It's actually the word for character. And it's the sense of what is used to show what is real. So Jesus came to planet Earth as the incarnation of God to show us what God is actually like. See, God the Father and God the Son are distinct, and yet they are one. This is part of the mystery, the paradox of the triunity of God. We can't understand it because our minds are finite, and this is an infinite sort of concept. But Jesus came in the flesh so that we could meet the Creator face to face, so that he could be interactive on a very personal level with his creation and even redeem his creatures, that is, humanity. You might remember that Jesus said to Philip, after Philip said, "If you just show us the Father, that'd be great." And Jesus' response was, "Philip, have I been with you all this time and you still do not comprehend that when you've seen me, you've seen the Father?" So that's the idea that the Hebrew writer is trying to bring across here. He's the radiance of God's glory. He's just the incarnation of it. He is the exact representation of his nature. When you see him, you've seen the Father. And he upholds all things by the word of his power. And that probably will remind you of something that Paul said to the Colossians about Jesus, that he's before all things, and in him everything holds together. See, Jesus is not just simply the creator, he is the maintainer. He keeps everything going, because once he decides that it all needs to end, he will release it, and everything will burn up and be replaced with a new heaven and a new earth, in which righteousness will dwell. So Jesus is the centerpiece of what the Hebrew writer wants us to think about, and that's really going to be the point of it, is that some of these Jewish Christians, because of the persecution that they were seeing against Christianity, were saying, you know what, I'm going to just focus on my Jewishness. I'm not going to talk an awful lot about Jesus. I'm not going to think an awful lot about Jesus. I'm going to just be Jewish. And the author of the letter, who is Jewish himself and a believer in Jesus, says, you can't do that, because Jesus is the whole point of Judaism. He is the climax of God's dealing with Israel. If you throw him under the bus, you don't have anything left. And so that's going to be the challenge being brought forth by this letter, is don't give up on Jesus. Don't be scared by the persecutions. Don't be worried about that, because the truth is, Jesus is everything to us. All right, back to verse 3. Let me read the first part again. He is the radiance of his glory, the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sin, so that would be the atonement, his death and resurrection, and the ascension as well, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And we know that. We know that he left planet Earth in the ascension, went back to be with his Father from eternity past, and he was seated at the right hand of the authority on high. In verse 4, having become as much better than the angels as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. Now, this is, again, very Jewish of this first century. The Jewish tradition the Pharisees being the ones that carried this forward, was that angels were very instrumental in everything that God does. And so they had a very high regard for angels. In fact, some of them had way too much regard for angels. They even got a little mystical about it. And you can see that in some of the fiction written by the Jewish people of the first century BC, first century AD. And so the writer says, look, Jesus is so much better than any angel you could imagine is important, because he has the more significant name than they do. Now, there's a play here of not just simply saying he's more respectable, he is more honorable, but there is actually reminding us of what his name is in Hebrew. His name is Yehoshua, which is the combination of God's divine name with the word salvation. So he is God's salvation. So he is better than any of the angels could even imagine to be, because he's got the more significant name than any of them. And all the angels that we ever meet in Scripture have special names that point something toward God, like Michael is who's like God, something like that. Gabriel is the strong man, the warrior that belongs to God. So here is the Hebrew writer saying, you like angels, you think angels are important. Well, guess what? They fade into insignificance when compared to Jesus, who is the creator, who is God in the flesh, who is the Savior. And then he asks this rhetorical question using Old Testament passages. And by the way, you've got to keep your fingers limbered up or be ready to click on hot links if you're using an electronic Bible to check out all the Old Testament quotations that are being made here. Verse 5, for to which of the angels did he ever say? And the assumption is none. He never said anything like this to a single angel. And here's the quote, which comes from Psalm chapter 2, verse 7. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. So none of the angels have ever been given that special address. Only Jesus, who has been eternally in relationship with God the Father, because he is God the Son. And this slaps right upside the head the foolish assertion made by the poorly Bible-educated founder of the Jehovah's Witnesses, that Jesus was Michael the archangel, because this writer says, no, nothing was ever said like this to any of the angels. And then again, here's another quote from another place in the Old Testament, this time 2 Samuel 7:14. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. That's a reference to something God said to David about his future son that would build the temple. So none of the angels have ever been given even a hint that they could be God's intimate son. Now, it's true, they are the sons of God. The Old Testament refers to them as the Ha-Bene Elohim, the sons of God. But that's a reference to them being directly created by God. This and these passages that are being quoted shows that none of them had this intimate personal status given to them, because Jesus is in a class by himself. Verse number 6, when he again brings the firstborn into the world, and that's clearly a reference to Jesus. He is the firstborn of all creation. And please do not make the mistake of thinking that the firstborn means first created. because Jesus was never created. He's just always been. That's part of being God. The word firstborn here is used in its technical sense of the heir, which he's just been mentioning an heir earlier. Now, how do I know that? Because Isaac is referred to as the firstborn of Abraham, and yet he wasn't the first son born to Abraham. That was Ishmael. So the term firstborn is more of the sense of the first ranking of the sons, the first ranking of those who have come from this personage. And so Jesus is the ranking son of God. He is the heir of all creation, which is exactly what Paul said about him. When he again brings the firstborn into the world, he says, and here's a nice little quote from this time it is Psalm 97, verse 7, "Let all the angels of God worship him." So Jesus is due worship by the angels. He is not an angel himself. That's the point that is being repeated over and over again in this first chapter. Quote 7, "And of the angels," he says, quote, "who makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire." Now this quote is taken from Psalm 104, verse 4, and I object to the English rendering of this, because I think it misses the point here. I'm going to give you an alternate translation, which is borne out in the Old Testament, and that is, "who makes into messengers spirit beings." See, instead of winds, it should be spirit beings. It's the same word. "And into servants," or ministers, "fiery flame beings." And we know that the seraphim, that's exactly what their name means, is fire, flame, burning. So this is a reference to angelic beings who serve as his messengers, because that's exactly what the word angel means. That's the Greek. Angelos means messenger. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew equivalent word means messenger. So he makes his spirit beings into his messengers, and he makes these fiery, flamey beings into his servants. And Jesus doesn't fall into the same group with them. He is in a class by himself as God incarnate. Verse 8, "but of the Son," he says, quote, and this one comes from Psalm 45, verse 6 and following, "Your throne, O God," and notice it is an address to God, and yet we're going to find out in a moment that this God has a God himself, which is exactly how the relationship is described with Jesus. He is God the Son, and then he shows his submission and his allegiance to God the Father. So, "your throne, O God," that would be Jesus, "is forever and ever, and the righteous scepter is the scepter of his kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God, your God," that would be God the Father, "has anointed you." The word anointed here is the word from which we get Mashiach, which is Messiah, which would be Jesus Christ. "Therefore, God, your God, the Father, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your companions." So Jesus is greater than anyone or anything because he is God the Son, and he rules upon the throne. Verse 10. And here's another quote. This time it comes from Psalm 102, verse 25. "You, Lord," and that's the divine name, "in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all become old like a garment, and like a mantle, you'll roll them up like a garment. They will also be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end. So a little reminder that the Creator is not part of the creation. He is not going to pass away like this fallen world will. He remains right to the end, and that would be Jesus. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And that's actually a quote that comes from later in this same book. Verse number 13. But to which of the angels has he ever said? So he's back to the rhetorical question again. And the answer is none of them. To which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? And that quote comes from Psalm 110, right at the very beginning of it. And it is used on several occasions in the New Testament in reference to Jesus. That God the Father says to Jesus the Son, after he's finished the atonement, after he's ascended back on high, here, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet, till we finish this story. And Paul, when he utilizes this, says, and the final enemy to be defeated is death itself. And that's something that Jesus will take care of at his second coming. And then we will finish with verse number 14 today, and we'll kind of kick it off with it as a review tomorrow. In reference to angels, are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? So angels, the supernatural beings, which we call angels, are nothing more than the servant class of the universe. God created them to support his work in saving souls, because he already knew that that was going to have to happen. Well, we'll mark our place right here and pick up on that thought tomorrow when we get back into the Word.